I find out that there are 35 different chemicals that EPA wants to take off the market that they are convinced cause birth defects, but because of a federal law that forces them to purchase the warehouse supply of that particular chemical. In that case, for the termite chemical, it's $110 million worth of chemical in a warehouse. They continue to let those 35 chemicals be used on the market. Now, there is a Republican congressman from Tennessee who's trying to change the law right now, but that's an example of where I would think someone could suggest that the federal government had signed off that that chemical's in use, and that chemical is, it's been suggested, causes birth defects. So I'm a little concerned about it's such broad language in this particular section that it covers everything, and I'm not convinced that looking to Washington, D.C. And relying on them is the best answer. In the case of the flannel pajamas, there again, my understanding is the federal government in that industry turns to the industry for the standards. And those are basically, industry writes the standards, they're given to the federal government, and then they're applied. So it's not a case of testing or anything else.
Well, so you're already speaking to the limitation that's contained in this proposed amendment here, which just goes to drugs, is that it?
Yeah, and I mean, I could probably support that, but I think even then there, you could provide instances where drugs have gotten through FDA. I do, my understanding is they're the only agency of the federal government that do the extensive testing, so I could probably support the amendment, but when we moved this bill out of committee, I guess it was a lack of forethought on my part and proper reflection. I did not understand the broad nature of things that this covers. And if you read the language, it's established, adopted, or approved, all of those things by the federal government, or one of those things by the federal government, and you don't have a case under this section. So I am a little concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, the purpose, I guess I'm speaking a little bit like Representative Dix, in the sense of the purpose was presented to us in the Senate that this was going to cover the people who are concerned with vaccines. And that's what we were concerned about at the time. We didn't really talk about it extending to lawnmowers and other kinds of products. We didn't talk about it. The record would show that we didn't talk about it. We were talking about trying to prevent the real punitive damages dealing with vaccines and the costs and to try to statutory deal with those costs. So that's what the testimony was all about. I think we just didn't get it done right.
Yeah, you could legitimately have a case where the government's allowing you to sell a product. A dramatic case would be the children's pajamas. You know that the children's pajamas are highly flammable, but the government continues to allow that, but the company knows that they're highly flammable. There are several instances of burns occurring to children due to the pajamas, but because we passed this section, punitives couldn't be applied because the government continues to allow them to sell the pajamas.
I think John wants to say something.
Mr. Chairman, it brings up the point, though, of aspirin. You know, it's recognized as being a really worthwhile drug, but it'll cause Reye syndrome in certain young people and can cause their death. But the government continues to authorize the sale and use of aspirin because of the general worth of the drug.
I think that's right.
Addition at the bottom there, which I recognize when Senator Brennan has pointed out, I could support this without additional language that I think would take care of the aspirin situation and comparable situations.
Okay. I didn't know if we were talking about including that language for sure or not.
Well, we're just kind of talking about it in general right now. Paul?
Well, generally, I think we should be careful in what this product liability first only relies to punitive damages, so it doesn't deal with compensatory damage. And second, it does not apply if there's clear and convincing evidence. And it goes on to talk about the information that might be available or withheld or intentionally misrepresented or known to be relevant. The example that was given with regard to given the material, but they knew it was highly flammable. Let's not overstep the bounds and read all sorts of nightmares into this thing, which may or may not exist.
Well, I guess to comment on that, my problem is that in some instances where either death or burns have occurred, I don't believe in punitive damages. I think those people should be put in prison. And I think that we missed the point with punitive damages. So I think where someone has knowingly made a product that caused children to burn up, they should have been put in prison. And I think that we're missing the point with punitive damages. So I guess I would take it one step further. I'm concerned that in this section, given that material and the fact that the federal government signed off on it, under this section you couldn't bring action for punitive damages.
Okay.
And that's not how it was represented in subcommittee or committee.
It did.
In our committee. Well, I don't know how much this was discussed on the Senate side, but apparently, perhaps as little as we had an opportunity to consider it on the House side. My concern would be, how would this affect the Pinto case? I mean, it's my understanding, I certainly could be mistaken on this, that basically the Pinto that was manufactured with the problem I think we're all aware of met the applicable federal and state standards at the time. And yet it was pretty clear from documents obtained from the company itself that they had made a calculated decision that scores of people were going to have to suffer because the company thought that was more profitable than installing a device that could have prevented those kinds of accidents. It's my sense now that companies aren't keeping those kinds of records anymore. So I don't know how a person would ever prove that, but I don't think we want to condone the kind of conduct that Ford Motor Company was found to have committed in those circumstances.
As I recall, the focus in the Senate hearing, somewhat to follow Senator Cohen's remark, was that there's a lot of concern among the party pharmaceutical manufacturers that they, public health people, that manufacturers are going to be afraid to try experimental things because they may get sued and so forth, and so we should try to protect the pharmaceutical companies and their efforts through experimentation to provide new medicines for the people. And that sounds like a lot.
We weren't even talking about new medicines. We were just talking about straight vaccines. Current accepted vaccines. It's not meant to. We were just talking about current accepted vaccines in order of getting people the willingness to provide vaccines in any case. Knowing that there's a certain percentage of people who have untoward effects to a vaccine.
Sure. Yes.
And that they didn't want to be sued for punitive because of an accepted vaccine product that they know there's going to be one out of every, 500,000 that has an adverse reaction to it. And we all still have gone ahead and said that that's better than the effects of the disease, so that there's some legitimacy there to warrant protection, because we know going in that you're going to have one out of X hundreds of thousands who has a really severe reaction to it in one way or another, and I think we've all determined that those vaccines still in the long run have they need to be used, and you prevent it. That's the risk we've all agreed to take on that. And so that's really was the discussion, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it was even talking about experimental pieces at that point. Straight out vaccines.
Well, as I recall, at least the contention made, I don't know if it was made to the committee or just to me individually, that the law inhibits pharmaceutical companies from trying to develop new vaccines, whereas if they had some immunity after they developed the vaccine where the government said it's okay, that would make a lot of difference. But in any event, I think you're right that it was pretty much confined to the issue of drugs and not this broad language. Is there is there a sense here that we should look at narrowing it? I'm not saying how, but is there a sense that we should look at narrowing this section or not?
That's a real important piece, as far as I'm concerned.
I know it is, Senator.
Trying to make up my past frailties of not being careful.
I didn't understand from John's comment.
No, I'm not entirely convinced of that myself, no.
Okay, you still... Well, given that some thought, I didn't know what
I
it was.
Still think the covering language, though, at the end, and sub A and B under sub 2, on withholding information when it's discovered, I think it covers those situations for the most part that we've discussed.
Okay, well, I think we've... kind of gotten each other's points of view on that. Let's go to the damages sections, pages 6 and 7. And yes.
I think the future damages are fine. That's included in D, and I...
Included in what? Did you say B or D?
D.
Yes.
See, it's got to go.
Line 6 and 7, by the way, on draft, on D and gross, I think it was everybody's... Everybody, I think, agreed in our preliminary discussions that should come out. Is that true?
We'll take that part out.
Subsection 2B should come out.
And then on 13, we're going to, I think, as far as I'm concerned, that's fine to leave it as D.
All right.
Which is advising the jury. That's... We had some discussion about that, Mr. Chairman. Are you ready to give up on that?
Yeah. I'm willing to go along with your suggestion that the D and gross version. That's all right. Line 13, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah,
that's all right.
I'm
yes.
Line 13.
Well, that's all right, I suppose. Anybody else want to comment on this? Okay. Anyway, we'll eliminate line 6 and 7 and at least tentatively look at D and gross. Rest of it. Pages 8 and 9 on joint and several liability. There are probably as many thoughts on how to draft that as there are members of this committee. And
I've got one.
I'll start by saying that I, of course, flinched greatly at the thought of monkeying around with the doctrine of joint and several liability at all, but we came up with the formula that you see in the scene grossed, and then the House changed that 10% business to 20%. So... and added a subsection 5 regarding hazardous substances, the dumping of hazardous substances, which I say makes ultimate good sense, because you never know who put how much goop in the pond. Well,
Mr. Chairman, for the record.
Go ahead. What did you say?
Oh, just for the record, you know, I mentioned to you earlier today, I came to the session with, in my mind, an elimination of joint and several, and that in the two minority reports I was involved with, they both carried the 20%. So I feel pretty strongly on this issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Dick.
I guess, for the record, I understand that joint and several is one of the probably the toughest issues we're going to have to deal with in this conference committee, just as it was one of the toughest issues I think probably both committees had to deal with. And we hear a lot of talk about the deep pocket. I have yet to see evidence that convinces me that that's a significant problem here in Oregon, but notwithstanding that, if we're going to deal with the area of limiting an injured party's ability to recover, when we start talking about recovery for their actual losses, not pain and suffering or non-economic losses, I can kind of see the handwriting there in terms of limiting, but when we talk about that person's medical bills, which aren't going to be paid, and that's a medical provider that's going to lose there. It's going to be the hospital, the doctor, the rehab specialist, the person that provides the prosthesis or the wheelchair. That's we're going to be asked to be, pay for that eventually. I mean, out of general assistance or out of our human services account, where the person's lost income because they can't work. I mean, philosophically, if we're stating our kind of concerns, that's when you're comparing an injured plaintiff against one or more defendants who have each been found to have been a substantial contributing factor to that innocent plaintiff's injuries. I think in terms of social policy and the message we want to send out, in terms of limiting a person's ability to recover those out-of-pocket economic losses, I think we're making a big mistake.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Yes, go right ahead.
You know, my concern is here is that someone minimally responsible is often left holding to pick up the burden on those injuries. And I think it's better to redo your philosophy on who picks up the tab than to someone who might be have a minimum responsibility and because they're well insured end up bearing the load of that cost. It happens time and time again in the local governments I've been involved with for a long time. It's just a foregone conclusion that a local government is insured and they're going to be part of it. No matter how they can be brought into it, they often are. That's just one example.
Well, I don't know how long we want to discuss this. I guess my just quick response would be people I've seen hurt by this, or that one example I can think of is the McMinnville school bus incident where a railroad wiped out the McMinnville school district bus and there were several kids who were really hurt badly and I think there were fatalities involved, and local government was let off the hook at that point because they were limited in their liability to $100,000-$300,000, and it was the railroad that got stuck in that instance because even though they were less at fault than the public agency, because the public agency's liability was limited, it was the railroad, the private entity, that got stuck in those circumstances. But I guess as I think we understand it, that defendant or those defendants are not going to be held liable at all unless a jury concludes that their fault was a substantial contributing factor. In other words, a but-for test. If that defendant didn't contribute in a substantial way to the loss, they're not going to be have any responsibility. That's, I guess, enough.
Well, does anyone here have any real problem with subsection 5 of the House the way it is now? It seems to be kind of limited when you stop to think about it, but just as limited to dump sites for hazardous substance, there may be maybe other comparable situations. Representative Dix.
Well, my concern is in, and I'll just put this on the table, is those people who illegally pollute either land or airshed or watershed underneath. For instance, if the hazardous substances had gotten into the watershed, had leaked into the watershed, I would like to see an exemption for that as well. I'm not talking about the people that have put in the scrubbers in their smokestacks and have complied with federal law with regard to air pollution, but I'm talking about those illegal air pollutants who it would be very hard to go in and say if they were 20% responsible for the pollution in the air that could be causing a health hazard, or five or six of them may be doing it. I'm not sure if we can come up with language along those lines, but something along those lines that would address watershed and airshed as well as just the dump site itself.
How come this is just limited to economic damages? Seemed like it.
You're talking about 5 and 5A.
Talking about the House version, subsection 5.
Sub 5 of section 7, Senator.
Yeah, sub 5.
Lines 13 to 15.
And I see it's limited economic damages. I'm wondering if the policy is good, which I think it is, why should you make the distinction? Why shouldn't the exemption in the rest of the section include all damages? Who's the end?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I suppose that. Well, I guess you're right. Yeah. I was thinking about it in a different context.
For one reason, right off the top, Mr. Chair. If you think about the situation we're trying to get at, where you've got multiple dumpers, perhaps over a long period of time, and we're exempting them, the economic process would be certainly calculable versus a non-economic. How many people does it apply to? What exactly would you be taking into consideration in that case? And I just think economic gives you a substantive issue to deal with.
Well, the Love Canal situation is the most graphic with respect to hazardous waste dumping illegally. And I think an interesting point has been raised.
Well, I know there's a lot of contention over this.
There wasn't a lot of discussion on this section, and I don't want to hold the committee up on it. Once again, my concern is that we try and figure out a way to include not just the ground pollution that can occur with hazardous waste dumping, but also pollution of the air, pollution underneath the initial ground surface, the watershed in particular, which more and more as we approach the year 2000, water will be a greater and greater, a great resource. So.
I think the concern about the water and if there's damages from water or air contamination because of the legal or illegal operation of the site, I think it's covered. But my concern is the use of the word dump site. I don't know what dump site means. I'd rather use it some sort of disposal rather than dump site. I don't know what that means. I'm not sure what dump site means, what we could define it. We've spent a lot of time in Ag and Natural Resources with lots of bills dealing with hazardous waste handling and disposal, and I'd just like to leave it hazardous legal or illegal operation of sort of contamination from hazardous substances in ways that doesn't confine it necessarily to dump sites. I mean, I don't know what a dump site is. John, you might want to comment about that. I don't know how we can deal with that. We've been through all of that. I mean, we're talking about.
If I might interject, the ORS defines dump site and is taken from, I believe, DEQ's definition of a dump site. The second thing is, as far as airshed and watershed, I was talking about any company, for instance, that's located in an industrial park. Or a group of companies that are located in an industrial park, let's say high tech as an example. Many times the chemicals they use to clean are highly toxic. And those, not that this would ever happen in this state because we have good high tech, good clean high tech industry here, but those pollutants 20 years from now were found in the watershed, and it was proved that 11 of the 12 companies at the site had been dumping those chemicals into the ground. It wouldn't have to be a waste site. I wasn't so much talking about that. I would like to see an exemption if it can be proven that there have been health problems caused by them polluting the watershed for the surrounding neighborhood. That's the kind of situation I was thinking of. But I too share your concern.
Well, I think there's some other statutes that you can reference to pick up those people that could be specific, but we need to look at that.
If anybody wants to,
I don't know.
All right, well, we can look at that. Good.
Well, I'm not suggesting that this has happened in Oregon, but I have seen in literature where, given some reporting requirements, for example, the Coast Guard, if a ship in navigable waters has some kind of problem in terms of any leaks and petroleum, you know, fuel oil, whatever they carry aboard, they're required to report immediately that problem to the harbor master or the Coast Guard or whoever. Sometimes these things happen in the evening hours, and unfortunately, it has been known to occur that when one company or individual or ship properly reports a problem, say they've dumped 50 gallons of bunker over the side because someone switched the wrong valve, once they put that report out, it becomes a signal for everybody else in the harbor to start dumping. They got a problem. Or they got something they want to get rid of. And that has happened.
Okay. Well, let me move to another part of this section. I'll have to confess that.
Excuse me. Didn't we have language at some point in time, Eric, that we dealt with hazardous waste disposal or something? It was in a general, more broader. We had some language that we were working with.
Well, in the original.
Was that the definition of commercial liability that we were? And what words did we use there? We actually took those people out.
Well, in the new definition, it refers to hazardous waste and environmental impairment insurance as being exempted from commercial liability. We didn't have that in, but we had talked about it when we passed Senate version and said that was something the House could fix if they wanted to. But we didn't ever have that in.
I was just kind of looking at the words.
Well, all I would think is, while Joyce looks over the definition, illegal operation or contamination from hazardous substances, I think would take care of air, water, land. You would address all your concerns without specifically identifying them, and therefore precluding consideration of something else if there was. So it might be a better way to do it.
Sounds like it might work. Council make a note of that and see if.
Representative Phillips, could you run that by me again?
Sure. I was just suggesting that resulting from the illegal or early operation and contamination from hazardous substances. And then if you look at the definition that's used, and again, Senator Cohen might come up with a more inclusive, although that's a pretty broad definition, from saying that using contamination, it covers the issue that Representative Dix raised with regard to water and
air.
At any rate, so it's kind of a combination of the two.
So you delete the language of a dump site for,
yeah,
and insert and contamination from.
Yeah, because once you say dump site, that draws the obvious conclusion that it's one single site or a location.
Okay, maybe council can come back with some precise language.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd ask Eric to just run that past someone like Jeanette Holtman. With this chapter rather
because I don't claim to be an expert
yeah,
in this
and
area.
Make sure that we get what we think we're getting when we use these words, and I think that's fine.
Okay. What chapter are you looking in?
Well, it's the hazardous substance it's the same references in here. It's 453-005, but there's some other. Just need to check with Jeanette, who's done most of the drafting on with the environmental, with the Superfund bill and all of those kinds of things.
Okay.
Now let's go to a different part of this thing. Now I think that, from my point of view, you're gonna have to get your thinking caps on here to figure out something else. I'm just really not prepared to move from 10% level or the 20% level unless we make some other changes in here, and I would be willing to consider raising that up. My preference, of course, would be, well, if we wanted to, if you want to make this percentage level, whatever the committee agrees on, if it's more than 10%, if you want to do that, then I'm going to suggest to you that you take a hard look at making that percentage apply across the board to all damages, economic and non-economic damages alike. I don't think that I... Well, maybe if I'm the only one that's concerned about going to 20%, why, I'll have to rethink my position, but
I think you'll find folks who are concerned about going to 20%. It's a question of what else, you know, what's the price of going to 20%?
Yeah. Well, that's what we ought to be thinking about, because, and I offer
or
that
15%
as...
15% or whatever.
Yeah, I offer that as a possibility. Anybody else have any comments on this before we move on?